Human actions are held in the two hemispheres. The Americans frequently term what we should call cupidity a laudable industry, and they blame as faint-heartedness what we consider to be the virtue of moderate desires. In France, simple tastes, orderly manners, domestic affections, and the attachments which men feel to the place of their birth are looked upon as great guarantees of the tranquility and happiness of the state. But in America, nothing seems to be more prejudicial to society than these virtues. The French Canadians, who have faithfully preserved the traditions of their pristine manners, are already embarrassed for room upon their small territory. And this little community, which has so recently begun to exist, will shortly be a prey to the calamities incident to old nations. In Canada, the most enlightened, patriotic, and humane inhabitants make extraordinary efforts to render the people dissatisfied with those simple enjoyments which still content it. There, the seductions of wealth are vaunted with as much zeal as the charms of an honest but limited income in the old world, and more exertions are made to excite the passions of the citizens there than to calm them elsewhere. If we listen to their eulogies, we shall hear that nothing is more praiseworthy than to exchange the pure and homely pleasures which even the poor man tastes in his own country for the dull delights of prosperity under a foreign sky. To leave the patrimonial hearth and the turf beneath which his forefathers sleep. In short, to abandon the living and the dead in quest of fortune. At the present time, America presents a field for human effort far more extensive than any sum of labor which can be applied to work it. In America, too much knowledge cannot be diffused, for all knowledge, whilst it may serve him who possesses it, turns also to the advantage of those who are without it. New wants are not to be feared, since they can be satisfied without difficulty. The growth of human passions need not be dreaded, since all passions may find an easy and a legitimate object. Nor can men be put in possession of too much freedom, since they are scarcely ever tempted to misuse their liberties. The American republics of the present day are like companies of adventurers formed to explore in common the wastelands of the New World and busied in a flourishing trade. The passions which agitate the Americans most deeply are not their political, but their commercial passions. Or, to speak more correctly, they introduce the habits they contract in business to their political life. They love order, without which affairs do not prosper. And they set an especial value upon a regular conduct which is the foundation of a solid business. They prefer the good sense which amasses large fortunes to that enterprising spirit which frequently dissipates them. General ideas alarm their minds, which are accustomed to positive calculations, and they hold practice in more honor than theory. It is in America that one learns to understand the influence which physical prosperity exercises over political actions, and even over opinions which ought to acknowledge no sway but that of reason. And it is more especially amongst strangers that this truth is perceptible. Most of the European emigrants to the New World carry with them that wild love of independence and of change, which our calamities are so apt to engender. I sometimes met with Europeans in the United States who had been obliged to leave their own country on account of their political opinions. They all astonished me by the language they held, but one of them surprised me more than all the rest. As I was crossing one of the most remote districts of Pennsylvania, I was benighted, and obliged to beg for hospitality at the gate of a wealthy planter, who was a Frenchman by birth. He bade me sit down beside his fire, and we began to talk with that freedom which benefits persons who meet in the backwoods, 2,000 leagues from their native country. I was aware that my host had been a great leveler and an ardent demagogue 40 years ago, and that his name was not unknown to fame. I was therefore not a little surprised to hear him discuss the rights of property as an economist or a landowner might have done. He spoke of the necessary gradations which fortune establishes among men, of obedience to established laws, of the influence of good morals in commonwealths, and of the support which religious opinions give to order and to freedom. He even went so far as to quote an evangelical authority in corroboration of one of his political tenets. I listened and marveled at the feebleness of human reason. A proposition is true or false, but no art can prove it to be one or the other, in the midst of the uncertainties of science and the conflicting lessons of experience, until a new incident disperses the clouds of doubt. I was poor, I become rich, and I am not to expect that prosperity will act upon my conduct and leave my judgment free. My opinions change with my fortune, and the happy circumstances which I turn to my advantage furnish me with that decisive argument which was before wanting. The influence of prosperity acts still more freely upon the American than upon strangers. The American has always seen the connection of public order and public prosperity, intimately united as they are, go on before his eyes. He does not conceive that one can subsist without the other. He has therefore nothing to forget, nor has he, like so many Europeans, to unlearn the lessons of his early education. Influence of the laws upon the maintenance of the Democratic Republic in the United States. The principal aim of this book has been to make known the laws of the United States. If this purpose has been accomplished, the listener is already enabled to judge for himself which are the laws that really tend to maintain the Democratic Republic and which endanger its existence. If I have not succeeded in explaining this in the whole course of my work, I cannot hope to do so within the limits of a single chapter. It is not my intention to retrace the path I have already pursued, and a very few lines will suffice to recapitulate what I have previously explained. Three circumstances seem to me to contribute most powerfully to the maintenance of the Democratic Republic in the United States. The first is that federal form of government which the Americans have adopted, and which enables the Union to combine the power of a great empire with the security of a small state. The second consists in those municipal institutions which limit the despotism of the majority, and at the same time impart a taste for freedom and a knowledge of the art of being free to the people. The third is to be met with in the constitution of the judicial power. I have shown in what manner the courts of justice serve to repress the excesses of democracy, and how they check and direct the impulses of the majority without stopping its activity. Influence of manners upon the maintenance of the Democratic Republic in the United States. I have previously remarked that the manners of the people may be considered as one of the general causes to which the maintenance of a democratic republic in the United States is attributable. I here used the word manners with the meaning which the ancients attached to the word mores, for I apply it not only to manners in their proper sense of what constitutes the character of social intercourse, but I extend it to the various notions and opinions current among men, and to the mass of those ideas which constitute their character of mind. I comprise, therefore, under this term the whole moral and intellectual condition of a people. My intention is not to draw a picture of American manners, but simply to point out such features of them as are favorable to the maintenance of political institutions. Religion, considered as a political institution, which powerfully contributes to the maintenance of the Democratic Republic amongst the Americans. Every religion is to be found in juxtaposition to a political opinion which is connected with it by affinity. If the human mind be left to follow its own bent, it will regulate the temporal and spiritual institutions of society upon one uniform principle. And man will endeavor, if I may use the expression, to harmonize the state in which he lives upon the earth with the state which he believes to await him in heaven. The greatest part of British America was peopled by men who, after having shaken off the authority of the Pope, acknowledged no other religious supremacy. They brought with them into the New World a form of Christianity which I cannot better describe than by styling it a democratic and republican religion. This sect contributed powerfully to the establishment of a democracy and a republic, and from the earliest settlement of the emigrants, politics and religion contracted an alliance which has never been dissolved. About 50 years ago, Ireland began to pour a Catholic population into the United States. On the other hand, the Catholics of America made proselytes, and at the present moment more than 1 million of Christians professing the truths of the Church of Rome are to be met with in the Union. The Catholics are faithful to the observances of their religion. They are fervent and zealous in the support and belief of their doctrines. Nevertheless, they constitute the most Republican and the most Democratic class of citizens which exists in the United States. And although this fact may surprise the observer at first, the causes by which it is occasioned may easily be discovered upon reflection. I think that the Catholic religion has erroneously been looked upon as the natural enemy of democracy. Amongst the various sects of Christians, Catholicism seems to me, on the contrary, to be one of those which are most favorable to the equality of conditions. In the Catholic Church, the religious community is composed of only two elements, the priest and the people. The priest alone rises above the rank of his flock, and all below him are equal. On doctrinal points, the Catholic faith places all human capacities upon the same level. It subjects the wise and ignorant, the man of genius and the vulgar crowd, to the details of the same creed. It imposes the same observances upon the rich and needy. It inflicts the same austerities upon the strong and the weak. It listens to no compromise with mortal man, but reducing all the human race to the same standard. It confounds all the distinctions of society at the foot of the same altar, even as they are confounded in the sight of God. If Catholicism predisposes the faithful to obedience, it certainly does not prepare them for inequality. But the contrary may be said of Protestantism, which generally tends to make men independent more than to render them equal. Catholicism is like an absolute monarchy. If the sovereign can be removed, all the other classes of society are more equal than they are in republics. It has not unfrequently occurred that the Catholic priest has left the service of the altar to mix with the governing powers of society and to take his place amongst the civil gradations of men. This religious influence has sometimes been used to secure the interests of that political state of things to which he belonged. At other times, Catholics have taken the side of aristocracy from a spirit of religion. But no sooner is the priesthood entirely separated from the government, as in the case of the United States, than is found that no class of men are more naturally disposed than the Catholics to transfuse the doctrine of the equality of conditions into the political world. If, then, the Catholic citizens of the United States are not forcibly led by the nature of their tenets to adopt democratic and republican principles, at least they are not necessarily opposed to them. And their social position, as well as their limited number, obliges them to adopt these opinions. Most of the Catholics are poor, and they have no chance of taking a part in the government unless it be open to all citizens. They constitute a minority, and all rights must be respected in order to ensure to them the free exercise of their own privileges. These two causes induce them, unconsciously, to adopt political doctrines, which they would perhaps support with less zeal if they were rich and preponderant. The Catholic clergy of the United States has never attempted to oppose this political tendency, but it seeks rather to justify its results. The priests in America have divided the intellectual world into two parts. In the one they place the doctrines of revealed religion, which command their assent. In the other, they leave those truths which they believe to have been freely left open to the researches of political inquiry. Thus, the Catholics of the United States are at the same time the most faithful believers and the most zealous citizens. It may be asserted that in the United States no religious doctrine displays the slightest hostility to democratic and republican institutions. The clergy of all the different sects hold the same language, their opinions are consonant to the laws, and the human intellect flows onwards in one sole current. I happened to be staying in one of the largest towns in the Union when I was invited to attend a public meeting which had been called for the purpose of assisting the polls and of sending them supplies of arms and money. I found 2,000 or 3,000 persons collected in a vast hall which had been prepared to receive them. In a short time, a priest in his ecclesiastical robes advanced to the front of the hustings. The spectators rose and stood uncovered, whilst he spoke in the following terms: Almighty God, the God of armies, Thou who didst strengthen the hearts and guide the arms of our fathers when they were fighting for the sacred rights of national independence, Thou who didst make them triumph over a hateful oppression and has granted to our people the benefits of liberty and peace, turn, O Lord, a favorable eye upon the other hemisphere. pitifully look down upon that heroic nation which is even now struggling as we did in the former time, and for the same rights which we defended with our blood. Thou who didst create man in the likeness of the same image, let not tyranny mar thy work, and establish inequality upon the earth. Almighty God, do thou watch over the destiny of the Poles, and render them worthy to be free. May thy wisdom direct their counsels, and may thy strength sustain their arms. Shed forth thy terror over their enemies, scatter the powers which take counsel against them, and vouchsafe that the injustice which the world has witnessed for 50 years be not consummated in our time. O Lord, who holdest alike the hearts of nations and of men in thy powerful hand, raise up allies to the sacred cause of right. Arouse the French nation from the apathy in which its rulers retain it, that go forth again to fight for the liberties of the world. Lord, turn not thou thy face from us, and grant that we may always be the most religious as well as the freest people of the earth. Almighty God, hear our supplications this day. Save the Poles, we beseech thee, in the name of thy well-beloved Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, who died upon the cross for the salvation of men. Amen. The whole meeting responded, Amen, with devotion. Indirect influence of religious opinions upon political society in the United States. I have just shown what the direct influence of religion upon politics is in the United States, but its indirect influence appears to me to be still more considerable, and it never instructs the Americans more fully in the art of being free than when it says nothing of freedom. The sects which exist in the United States are innumerable. They all differ in respect to the worship which is due from man to his Creator, but they all agree in respect to the duties which are due from man to man. Each sect adores the deity in its own peculiar manner, but all the sects preach the same moral law in the name of God. If it be of the highest importance to man as an individual that his religion should be true, the case of society is not the same. Society has no future life to hope for or to fear. And provided the citizens profess a religion, the peculiar tenets of that religion are of very little importance to its interests. Moreover, almost all the sects of the United States are comprised within the great unity of Christianity, and Christian morality is everywhere the same. It may be believed without unfairness that a certain number of Americans pursue a peculiar form of worship, from habit more than from conviction. In the United States, the sovereign authority is religious, and consequently hypocrisy must be common. But there is no country in the whole world in which the Christian religion retains a greater influence over the souls of men than in America. And there can be no greater proof of its utility and of its conformity to human nature than that its influence is most powerfully felt over the most enlightened and free nation of the earth. I have remarked that the members of the American clergy in general, without even accepting those who do not admit religious liberty, are all in favor of civil freedom. But they do not support any particular political system. They keep aloof from parties and from public affairs. In the United States, religion exercises but little influence upon the laws and upon the details of public opinion. But it directs the manners of the community, and by regulating domestic life, it regulates the state. I do not question that the great austerity of manners which is observable in the United States arises in the first instance from religious faith. Religion is often unable to restrain man from the numberless temptations of fortune. Nor can it check that passion for gain which every incident of his life contributes to arouse, but its influence over the mind of woman is supreme, and women are the protectors of morals. There is certainly no country in the world where the tie of marriage is so much respected as in America, or where conjugal happiness is more highly or worthily appreciated. In Europe, almost all the disturbances of society arise from the irregularities of domestic life. To despise the natural bonds and legitimate pleasures of home is to contract a taste for excesses, a restlessness of heart, and the evil of fluctuating desires. Agitated by the tumultuous passions for which frequently disturb his dwelling, the European is galled by the obedience which the legislative powers of the state exact. But when the American retires from the turmoil of public life to the bosom of his family, he finds it in the image of order and of peace. There his pleasures are simple and natural, his joys are innocent and calm, and as he finds that an orderly life is the surest path to happiness, he accustoms himself without difficulty to moderate his opinions as well as his tastes. Whilst the European endeavors to forget his domestic troubles by agitating society, the American derives from his own home that love of order which he afterwards carries with him into public affairs. In the United States, the influence of religion is not confined to the manners, but it extends to the intelligence of the people. Amongst the Anglo-Americans, there are some who profess the doctrines of Christianity from a sincere belief in them, and others who do the same because they are afraid to be suspected of unbelief. Christianity, therefore, reigns without any obstacle, by universal consent. The consequence is, as I have before observed, that every principle of the moral world is fixed and determinate, although the political world is abandoned to the debates and the experiments of men. Thus, the human mind is never left to wander across a boundless field, and whatever may be its pretensions, it is checked from time to time by barriers which it cannot surmount. Before it can perpetrate innovation, certain primal and immutable principles are laid down, and the boldest conceptions of human device are subjected to certain forms which retard and stop their completion. The imagination of the Americans, even in its greatest flights, is circumspect and undecided, its impulses are checked, and its works unfinished. These habits of restraint recur in political society, and are singularly favorable both to the tranquility of the people and to the durability of the institutions it has established. Nature and circumstances concurred to make the inhabitants of the United States bold men, as is sufficiently attested by the enterprising spirit with which they seek for fortune. If the mind of the Americans were free from all trammels, they would very shortly become the most daring innovators and the most implacable disputants in the world. But the revolutionists of America are obliged to profess an ostensible respect for Christian morality and equity, which does not easily permit them to violate the laws that oppose their designs. Nor would they find it easy to surmount the scruples of their partisans, even if they were able to get over their own. Hitherto, no one in the United States has dared to advance the maxim that everything is permissible with a view to the interests of society. An impious adage which seems to have been invented in an age of freedom to shelter all the tyrants of future ages. Thus, whilst the law permits the Americans to do what they please, religion prevents them from conceiving and forbids them to commit what is rash or unjust. Religion in America takes no direct part in the government of society, but it must nevertheless be regarded as the foremost of the political institutions of that country. For if it does not impart a taste of freedom, it facilitates the use of free institutions. Indeed, it is the same point of view that the inhabitants of the United States themselves look upon religious belief. I do not know whether all the Americans have a sincere faith in their religion, for who can search the human heart? But I am certain that they hold it to be indispensable to the maintenance of republican institutions. This opinion is not peculiar to a class of citizens or to a party, but it belongs to the whole nation and to every rank of society. In the United States, if a political character attacks a sect, this may not prevent even the partisans of that very sect from supporting him. But if he attacks all the sects together, everyone abandons him and he remains alone. Whilst I was in America, a witness who happened to be called at the assizes of the county of Chester, state of New York, declared that he did not believe in the existence of God or in the immortality of the soul. The judge refused to admit his evidence on the ground that the witness had destroyed beforehand all the confidence of the court in what he was about to say. Author's note: The New York Spectator of August 23, 1831, relates the fact in the following terms. The Court of Common Pleas of Chester County, New York, a few days since rejected a witness who declared his disbelief in the existence of God. The presiding judge remarked that he had not before been aware that there was a man living who did not believe in the existence of God, that this belief constituted the sanction of all testimony in a court of justice, and that he knew of no cause in a Christian county where a witness had been permitted to testify without such belief. The newspapers related the fact without any further comment. The Americans combine the notions of Christianity and of liberty so intimately in their minds that it is impossible to make them conceive the one without the other. And with them, this conviction does not spring from that barren traditionary faith which seems to vegetate in the soul rather than to live. I have known of societies formed by the Americans to send out ministers of the gospel into the new Western states to found schools and churches there, lest religion should be suffered to die away in those remote settlements, and the rising states be less fitted to enjoy free institutions than the people from which they emanated. I met with wealthy New Englanders who abandoned the country in which they were born in order to lay the foundations of Christianity and of freedom on the banks of the Missouri or in the prairies of Illinois. Thus, religious zeal is perpetually stimulated in the United States by the duties of patriotism. These men do not act from the exclusive consideration of the promises of a future life. Eternity is only one motive of their devotion to the cause. And if you converse with these missionaries of Christian civilization, you will be surprised to find how much value they set upon the goods of this world, and that you meet with a politician where you expected to find a priest. They will tell you that all the American republics are collectively involved with each other. If the republics of the West were to fall into anarchy or to be mastered by a despot, the republican institutions, which now flourish upon the shores of the Atlantic Ocean, would be in great peril. It is, therefore, our interest that the new states should be religious in order to maintain our liberties. Such are the opinions of the Americans. And if any hold that the religious spirit, which I admire, is the very thing most amiss in America, and that the only element wanting to the freedom and happiness of the human race is to believe in some blind cosmogony, or to assert with Cavani the secretion of the thought by the brain, I can only reply that those who hold this language have never been in America, and that they have never seen a religious or a free nation. When they return from their expedition, we shall hear what they have to say. There are persons in France who look upon republican institutions as a temporary means of power, of wealth, and distinction. Men who are the condottieri of liberty, and who fight for their own advantage, whatever be the colors they wear. It is not to these that I address myself. But there are others who look forward to the republican forms of government as a tranquil and lasting state, towards which modern society is daily impelled by the ideas and manners of the time, and who sincerely desire to prepare men to be free. When these men attack religious opinions, they obey the dictates of their passions to the prejudice of their interests. Despotism may govern without faith, but liberty cannot. Religion is much more necessary in the republic which they set forth in glowing colors than in the monarchy which they attack, and it is more needed in democratic republics than in any others. How is it possible that society should escape destruction if the moral tie be not strengthened in proportion as the political tie is relaxed? And what can be done with a people which is its own master, if it be not submissive to the divinity? Principal causes which render religion powerful in America. The philosophers of the 18th century explained the gradual decay of religious faith in a very simple manner. Religious zeal, they said, must necessarily fail, the more generally liberty is established and knowledge diffused. Unfortunately, facts are by no means in accordance with their theory. There are certain populations in Europe whose unbelief is only equaled by their ignorance and their debasement, whilst in America, one of the freest and most enlightened nations in the world, fulfills all the outward duties of religious fervor. Upon my arrival in the United States, the religious aspect of the country was the first thing that struck my attention. and the longer I stayed there, the more did I perceive the great political consequences resulting from this state of things, to which I was unaccustomed. In France, I had almost always seen the spirit of religion and the spirit of freedom pursuing courses diametrically opposed to each other. But in America, I found that they were intimately united, and that they reigned in common over the same country. My desire to discover the causes of this phenomenon increased from day to day. In order to satisfy it, I questioned the members of all the different sects, and I more especially sought the society of the clergy, who are the depositaries of the different persuasions, and who are more especially interested in their duration. As a member of the Roman Catholic Church, I was more particularly brought into contact with several of its priests, with whom I became intimately acquainted. To each of these men, I expressed my astonishment and I explained my doubts. I found that they differed upon matters of detail alone, and that they mainly attributed the peaceful dominion of religion in their country to the separation of church and state. I do not hesitate to affirm that during my stay in America I did not meet with a single individual of the clergy or of the laity who was not of the same opinion upon this point. This led me to examine more attentively than I had hitherto done the station which the American clergy occupy in political society. I learned with surprise that they filled no public appointments, unless his term be applied to the functions which many of them fill in the schools. Almost all education is entrusted to the clergy. Not one of them is to be met with in the administration, and they are not even represented in the legislative assemblies. In several states, the law excludes them from political life, public opinion in all. Author's note. See the Constitution of New York, Article 7, Section 4. And whereas the ministers of the gospel are, by their profession, dedicated to the service of God and the care of souls, and ought not to be diverted from the great duties of their functions, therefore no minister of the gospel, or priest of any denomination whatsoever, shall at any time hereafter, under any pretense or description whatever, be eligible to or capable of holding any civil or military office or place within this state. And when I came to inquire into the prevailing spirit of the clergy, I found that most of its members seemed to retire of their own accord from the exercise of power, and that they made it the pride of their profession to abstain from politics. I heard them inveigh against ambition and deceit, under whatever political opinions these vices might chance to lurk. But I learned from their discourses that men are not guilty in the eye of God for any opinions concerning political government which they may profess with sincerity, any more than they are for their mistakes in building a house or in driving a furrow. I perceived that these ministers of the gospel eschewed all parties with the anxiety attendant upon personal interest. These facts convinced me that what I had been told was true, and it then became my object to investigate their causes, and to inquire how it happened that the real authority of religion was increased by a state of things which diminished its apparent force. These causes did not long escape my researches. The short space of 80 years can never content the imagination of man, nor can the imperfect joys of this world satisfy his heart. Man alone, of all created beings, displays a natural contempt of existence, and yet a boundless desire to exist. He scorns life, but he dreads annihilation. These different feelings incessantly urge his soul to the contemplation of a future state, and religion directs his musings thither. Religion, then, is simply another form of hope, and it is no less natural to the human heart than hope itself. Men cannot abandon their religious faith without a kind of aberration of intellect, and a sort of violent distortion of their true natures. But they are invincibly brought back to more pious sentiments, for unbelief is an accident, and faith is the only permanent state of mankind. If we only consider religious institutions in a purely human point of view, they may be said to derive an inexhaustible element of strength from man himself, since they belong to one of the constituent principles of human nature. I am aware that at certain times religion may strengthen this influence, which originates in itself, by the artificial power of the laws and by the support of those temporal institutions which direct society. Religions, intimately united to the governments of the earth, have been known to exercise a sovereign authority derived from the twofold source of terror and of faith. But when a religion contracts an alliance of this nature, I do not hesitate to affirm that it commits the same error as a man who should sacrifice his future to his present welfare. And in obtaining a power to which it has no claim, it risks that authority which is rightfully its own. When a religion founds its empire upon the desire of immortality which lives in every human heart, it may aspire to universal dominion. But when it connects itself with a government, it must necessarily adopt maxims which are only applicable to certain nations. Thus, in forming an alliance with a political power, religion augments its authority over a few and forfeits the hope of reigning over all. As long as religion rests upon those sentiments which are the consolation of all affliction, it may attract the affections of mankind. But if it be mixed up with the bitter passions of the world, it may be constrained to defend allies whom its interests, and not the principle of love, have given to it, or to repel as antagonists men who are still attached to its own spirit, however opposed they may be to the powers to which it is allied. The church cannot share the temporal power of the state without being the object of a portion of that animosity which the latter excites. The political powers which seem to be most firmly established have frequently no better guarantee for their duration than the opinions of a generation, the interests of the time, or the life of an individual. A law may modify the social condition which seems to be most fixed and determinate, and with the social condition everything else must change. The powers of society are more or less fugitive, like the years which we spend upon the earth. They succeed each other with rapidity, like the fleeting cares of life. And no government has ever yet been founded upon an invariable disposition of the human heart, or upon an imperishable interest. As long as a religion is sustained by those feelings, propensities, and passions, which are found to occur under the same forms, at all the different periods of history, it may defy the efforts of time. Or at least it can only be destroyed by another religion. But when religion clings to the interests of the world, it becomes almost as fragile a thing as the powers of earth. It is the only one of them all which can hope for immortality. But if it be connected with their ephemeral authority, it shares their fortunes, and may fall with those transient passions which supported them for a day. The alliance which religion contracts with political powers must needs be onerous to itself, since it does not require their assistance to live, and by giving them its assistance, it may be exposed to decay. The danger which I have just pointed out always exists, but it is not always equally visible. In some ages, governments seem to be imperishable. In others, the existence of society appears to be more precarious than the life of man. Some constitutions plunge the citizens into a lethargic somnolence, and others rouse them to feverish excitement. When governments appear to be so strong and laws so stable, men do not perceive the dangers which may accrue from a union of church and state. When governments display so much weakness and laws so much inconstancy, the danger is self-evident, but it is no longer possible to avoid it. To be effectual, measures must be taken to discover its approach. In proportion as a nation assumes a democratic condition of society, and as communities display democratic propensities, it becomes more and more dangerous to connect religion with political institutions. For the time is coming when authority will be bandied from hand to hand, when political theories will succeed each other, and when men, laws, and constitutions will disappear or be modified from day to day, and this not for a season only, but unceasingly. Agitation and mutability are inherent in the nature of democratic republics, just as stagnation and inertness are the law of absolute monarchies. If the Americans, who change the head of the government once in 4 years, who elect new legislators every 2 years, and renew the provincial officers every 12 months, if the Americans, who have abandoned the political world to the attempts of innovators, had not placed religion beyond their reach, where could it abide in the ebb and flow of human opinions? Where would that respect which belongs to it be paid amidst the struggles of faction? And what would become of its immortality in the midst of perpetual decay? The American clergy were the first to perceive this truth and to act in conformity with it. They saw that they must renounce their religious influence if they were to strive for political power, and they chose to give up the support of the state rather than to share its vicissitudes. In America, religion is perhaps less powerful than it has been at certain periods in the history of certain peoples, but its influence is more lasting. It restricts itself to its own resources, but of those none can deprive it. Its circle is limited to certain principles, but those principles are entirely its own and under its undisputed control. On every side in Europe we hear voices complaining of the absence of religious faith and inquiring the means of restoring to religion some remnant of its pristine authority. It seems to me that we must first attentively consider what ought to be the natural state of men with regard to religion at the present time, and when we know what we have to hope and to fear, we may discern the end to which our efforts ought to be directed. The two great dangers which threaten the existence of religion are schism and indifference. In ages of fervent devotion, men sometimes abandon their religion, but they only shake it off in order to adopt another. Their faith changes the objects to which it is directed, but it suffers no decline. The old religion then excites enthusiastic attachment or bitter enmity in either party. Some leave it with anger, others cling to it with increased devotedness. And although persuasions differ, irreligion is unknown. Such, however, is not the case when a religious belief is secretly undermined by doctrines which may be termed negative, since they deny the truth of one religion without affirming that of any other. Prodigious revolutions then take place in the human mind without the apparent cooperation of the passions of man, and almost without his knowledge. Men lose the objects of their fondest hopes, as if through forgetfulness. They are carried away by an imperceptible current which they have not the courage to stem, but which they follow with regret, since it bears them from a faith they love to a skepticism that plunges them into despair. In ages which answer to this description, men desert their religious opinions from lukewarmness rather than from dislike. They do not reject them, but the sentiments by which they were once fostered disappear. But if the unbeliever does not admit religion to be true, he still considers it useful. Regarding religious institutions in a human point of view, he acknowledges their influence upon manners and legislation. He admits that they may serve to make men live in peace with one another and to prepare them gently for the hour of death. He regrets the faith which he has lost. And as he is deprived of a treasure which he has learned to estimate at its full value, he scruples to take it from those who still possess it. On the other hand, those who continue to believe are not afraid openly to avow their faith. They look upon those who do not share their persuasion as more worthy of pity than of opposition. And they are aware that to acquire the esteem of the unbelieving, they are not obliged to follow their example. They are hostile to no one in the world. And as they do not consider the society in which they live as an arena in which religion is bound to face its thousand deadly foes, they love their contemporaries, whilst they condemn their weaknesses and lament their errors. As those who do not believe conceal their incredulity, and as those who believe display their faith, public opinion pronounces itself in favor of religion. Love, support, and honor are bestowed upon it, and it is only by searching the human soul that we can detect the wounds which it has received. The mass of mankind, who are never without the feeling of religion, do not perceive anything at variance with the established faith. The instinctive desire of a future life brings the crowd about the altar and opens the hearts of men to the precepts and consolations of religion. But this picture is not applicable to us, for there are men amongst us who have ceased to believe in Christianity without adopting any other religion. Others, who are in the perplexities of doubt and who already affect not to believe, and others again who are afraid to avow the Christian faith which they still cherish in secret. Amidst these lukewarm partisans and ardent antagonists, a small number of believers exist, who are ready to brave all obstacles and to scorn all dangers in defense of their faith. They have done violence to human weakness in order to rise superior to public opinion. Excited by the effort they have made, they scarcely know where to stop. And as they know that the first use which the French made of independence was to attack religion, they look upon their contemporaries with dread, and they recoil in alarm from the liberty which their fellow citizens are seeking to obtain. As unbelief appears to them to be a novelty, they comprise all that is new in one indiscriminate animosity. They are at war with their age and country, and they look upon every opinion which is put forth there as the necessary enemy of the faith. Such is not the natural state of men with regard to religion at the present day, and some extraordinary or incidental cause must be at work in France to prevent the human mind from following its original propensities and to drive it beyond the limits at which it ought naturally to stop. I am intimately convinced that this extraordinary and incidental cause is the close connection of politics and religion. The unbelievers of Europe attack the Christians as their political opponents rather than as their religious adversaries. They hate the Christian religion as an opinion of a party much more than as an error of belief, and they reject the clergy less because they are the representatives of the divinity than because they are the allies of authority. In Europe, Christianity has been intimately united to the powers of the earth. Those powers are now in decay, and as it is, as it were, buried under their ruins. The living body of religion has been bound down to the dead corpse of superannuated polity. Cut but the bonds which restrain it, and that which is alive will rise once more. I know not what could restore the Christian Church of Europe to the energy of its earlier days. That power belongs to God alone. But it may be the effect of human policy to leave the faith in the full exercise of the strength which it still retains. How the instruction, the habits, and the practical experience of the Americans promote the success of their democratic institutions. I have but little to add to what I have already said concerning the influence which the instruction and the habits of the Americans exercise upon the maintenance of their political institutions. America has hitherto produced very few writers of distinction. It possesses no great historians, and not a single eminent poet. The inhabitants of that country look upon what are properly styled literary pursuits with a kind of disapprobation. And there are towns of very second-rate importance in Europe, in which more literary works are annually published than in the 24 states of the Union put together. The spirit of the Americans is averse to general ideas, and it does not seek theoretical discoveries. Neither politics nor manufactures direct them to these occupations. And although new laws are perpetually enacted in the United States, no great writers have hitherto inquired into the general principles of their legislation. The Americans have lawyers and commentators, but no jurists. And they furnish examples rather than lessons to the world. The same observation applies to the mechanical arts. In America, the inventions of Europe are adopted with sagacity. They are perfected and adapted with admirable skill to the wants of the country. Manufactures exist, but the science of manufacture is not cultivated, and they have good workmen, but very few inventors. Fulton was obliged to proffer his service to foreign nations for a long time before he was able to devote them to his own country. The observer who is desirous of forming an opinion on the state of instruction amongst the Anglo-Americans must consider the same object from two different points of view. If he only singles out the learned, he will be astonished to find how rare they are. But if he counts the ignorant, the American people will appear to be the most enlightened community in the world. The whole population, as I observed in another place, is situated between these two extremes. In New England, every citizen receives the elementary notions of human knowledge. He is, moreover, taught the doctrines and the evidences of his religion, the history of his country, and the leading features of its constitution. In the states of Connecticut and Massachusetts, it is extremely rare to find a man imperfectly acquainted with all these things, and a person wholly ignorant of them is a sort of phenomenon. When I compare the Greek and Roman republics with these American states, the manuscript libraries of the former and their rude population with the innumerable journals and the enlightened people of the latter, when I remember all the attempts which are made to judge the modern republics by the assistance of those of antiquity, and to infer what will happen in our time from what took place 2,000 years ago, I am tempted to burn my books in order to apply none but novel ideas to so novel a condition of society. What I have said of New England must not, however, be applied indistinctly to the whole Union. As we advance towards the West or the South, the instruction of the people diminishes. In the states which are adjacent to the Gulf of Mexico, a certain number of individuals may be found, as in our own countries, who are devoid of the rudiments of instruction. But there is not a single district in the United States sunk in complete ignorance, and for a very simple reason. The peoples of Europe started from the darkness of a barbarous condition to advance toward the light of civilization. Their progress has been unequal. Some of them have improved apace, whilst others have loitered in their course, and some have stopped and are still sleeping upon the way. Such has not been the case in the United States. The Anglo-Americans settled in a state of civilization upon that territory which their descendants occupy. They had not to begin to learn, and it was sufficient for them not to forget. Now the children of these same Americans are the persons who, year by year, transport their dwellings into the wilds. And with their dwellings, their acquired information and their esteem for knowledge. Education has taught them the utility of instruction, and has enabled them to transmit that instruction to their posterity. In the United States, society has no infancy, but it is born in man's estate. The Americans never use the word peasant, because they have no idea of the peculiar class which that term denotes. The ignorance of more remote ages, the simplicity of rural life, and the rusticity of the villager have not been preserved amongst them. And they are alike unacquainted with the virtues, the vices, the coarse habits, and the simple graces of an early stage of civilization. At the extreme borders of the Confederate States, upon the confines of society and of the wilderness, a population of bold adventurers have taken up their abode, who pierce the solitudes of the American woods and seek a country there in order to escape that poverty which awaited them in their native provinces. As soon as the pioneer arrives upon the spot which is to serve him for a retreat, he fells a few trees and builds a log house. Nothing can offer a more miserable aspect than these isolated dwellings. The traveler who approaches one of them towards nightfall sees the flicker of the hearth flame through the chinks in the walls. And at night, if the wind rises, he hears the roof of boughs shake to and fro in the midst of the great forest trees. Who would not suppose that this poor hut is the asylum of rudeness and ignorance? Yet no sort of comparison can be drawn between the pioneer and the dwelling which shelters him. Everything about him is primitive and uninformed, but he is himself the result of the labor and the experience of 18 centuries. He wears the dress, and he speaks the language of cities. He is acquainted with the past, curious of the future, and ready for argument upon the present. He is, in short, a highly civilized being who consents for a time to inhabit the backwoods and who penetrates into the wilds of the New World with the Bible and axe and a file of newspapers. It is difficult to imagine the incredible rapidity with which public opinion circulates in the midst of these deserts. Author's note: I traveled along a portion of the frontier of the United States in a sort of cart which was termed the mail. We passed, day and night, with great rapidity along the roads which were scarcely marked out, through immense forests. When the gloom of the woods became impenetrable, the coachman lighted branches of fir, and we journeyed along by the light they cast. From time to time we came to a hut in the midst of the forest, which was a post office. The mail dropped an enormous bundle of letters at the door of this isolated dwelling, and we pursued our way at full gallop, leaving the inhabitants of the neighboring log houses to send for their share of the treasure. I do not think that so much intellectual intercourse takes place in the most enlightened and populous districts in France. Author's note: in 1832, each inhabitant of Michigan paid a sum equivalent to 1 franc 22 cents to the post office revenue, and each inhabitant of the Floridas paid 1 franc 5 cents. In the same year, each inhabitant of the Département du Nord paid 1 franc 4 cents to the revenue of the French post office. Now, the state of Michigan only contained at that time 7 inhabitants per square league, and Florida only 5. The public instruction and the commercial activity of these districts is inferior to that of most of the states in the Union, whilst the Département du Nord, which contains 3,400 inhabitants per square league, is one of the most enlightened and manufacturing parts of France. It cannot be doubted that in the United States, the instruction of the people powerfully contributes to the support of a democratic republic. And such must always be the case, I believe, where instruction which awakens the understanding is not separated from moral education which amends the heart. But I by no means exaggerate this benefit. And I am still further from thinking, as so many people do think in Europe, that men can be instantaneously made citizens by teaching them to read and write. True information is mainly derived from experience, and if the Americans had not been gradually accustomed to govern themselves, their book learning would not assist them much at the present day. I have lived a great deal with the people in the United States, and I cannot express how much I admire their experience and their good sense. An American should never be allowed to speak of Europe, for he will then probably display a vast deal of presumption and very foolish pride. He will take up with those crude and vague notions which are so useful to the ignorant all over the world. But if you question him regarding his own country, the cloud which dimmed his intelligence will immediately disperse. His language will become as clear and as precise as his thoughts. He will inform you what his rights are, and by what means he exercises them. He will be able to point out the customs which obtain in the political world. You will find that he is well acquainted with the rules of the administration, and that he is familiar with the mechanism of the laws. The citizen of the United States does not acquire his practical science and his positive notions from books. The instruction he has acquired may have prepared him for receiving those ideas, but it did not furnish them. The American learns to know the laws by participating in the act of legislation, and he takes a lesson in the forms of government from governing. The great work of society is ever going on beneath his eyes and, as it were, under his hands. In the United States, politics are the end and aim of education. In Europe, its principal object is to fit men for private life. The interference of the citizens in public affairs is too rare an occurrence for it to be anticipated beforehand. Upon casting a glance over society in the two hemispheres, these differences are indicated even by its external aspect. In Europe, we frequently introduce the ideas and the habits of private life into public affairs. And as we pass at once from the domestic circle to the government of the state, we may frequently be heard to discuss the great interests of society in the same manner in which we converse with our friends. The Americans, on the other hand, transfuse the habits of public life into their manners in private, and in their country the jury is introduced into the games of schoolboys, and parliamentary forms are observed in the order of a feast. The laws contribute more to the maintenance of the democratic republic in the United States than the physical circumstances of the country, and the manners more than the laws. I have remarked that the maintenance of democratic institutions in the United States is attributable to the circumstances, the laws, and the manners of that country. Author's note: I remind the listener of the general significance which I give to the word manners, namely, the moral and intellectual characteristics of social man taken collectively. Most Europeans are only acquainted with the first of these three causes, and they are apt to give it a preponderating importance which it does not really possess. It is true that the Anglo-Saxons settled in the New World in the state of social equality, The low-born and the noble were not to be found amongst them, and professional prejudices were always as entirely unknown as the prejudices of birth. Thus, as the condition of society was democratic, the empire of democracy was established without difficulty. But this circumstance is by no means peculiar to the United States. Almost all the transatlantic colonies were founded by men equal amongst themselves, or who became so by inhabiting them. In no one part of the New World have Europeans been able to create an aristocracy. Nevertheless, democratic institutions prosper nowhere but in the United States. The American Union has no enemies to contend with. It stands in the wilds like an island in the ocean. But the Spaniards of South America were no less isolated by nature, yet their position has not relieved them from the charge of standing armies. They make war upon each other when they have no foreign enemies to oppose, and the Anglo-American democracy is the only one which has hitherto been able to maintain itself in peace. The territory of the Union presents a boundless field to human activity and inexhaustible materials for industry and labor. The passion of wealth takes the place of ambition, and the warmth of faction is mitigated by a sense of prosperity. But in what portion of the globe shall we meet with more fertile plains, with mightier rivers, or with more unexplored and inexhaustible riches than in South America? Nevertheless, South America has been unable to maintain democratic institutions. If the welfare of nations depended on their being placed in a remote position with an unbounded space of habitable territory before them, the Spaniards of South America would have no reason to complain of their fate. And although they might enjoy less prosperity than the inhabitants of the United States, their lot might still be such as to excite the envy of some nations in Europe. There are, however, no nations upon the face of the earth more miserable than those of South America. Thus, not only are physical causes inadequate to produce results analogous to those which occur in North America, but they are unable to raise the population of South America above the level of European states, where they act in a contrary direction. Physical causes do not, therefore, affect the destiny of nations so much as has been supposed. I have met with men in New England who were on the point of leaving a country where they might have remained in easy circumstances to go seek their fortune in the wilds. Not far from that district, I found a French population in Canada, which was closely crowded on a narrow territory, although the same wilds were at hand. And whilst the emigrant from the United States purchased an extensive estate with the earnings of a short term of labor, the Canadian paid as much for land as he would have done in France. Nature offers the solitudes of the New World to Europeans, but they are not always acquainted with the means of turning her gifts to account. Other peoples of America have the same physical conditions of prosperity as the Anglo-Americans, but without their laws and their manners, and these people are wretched. The laws and manners of the Anglo-Americans are therefore that efficient cause of their greatness which is the object of my inquiry. I am far from supposing that the American laws are preeminently good in themselves. I do not hold them to be applicable to all democratic peoples, and several of them seem to be dangerous, even in the United States. Nevertheless, it cannot be denied that the American legislation, taken collectively, is extremely well adapted to the genius of the people and the nature of the country which it is intended to govern. The American laws are therefore good, and to them must be attributed a large portion of the success which attends the government of democracy in America. But I do not believe them to be the principal cause of that success. And if they seem to me to have more influence upon the social happiness of the Americans than the nature of the country,